Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today, produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We tend to speak of the real estate industry like one gigantic market, like a house is a house is a house. That is so not true on a whole lot of levels, the most basic one of which is this. You got your new homes and you got your used homes. And we learned once again today that new and used just don't sell the same way. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday. It is the 23rd of December today. And this was one of those days where the economic statistic du jour just made you want to say, come on, man. How are we supposed to know what's going on when we get numbers like these? The Commerce Department reported this morning that sales of newly built houses fell more than 11% last month. Fell, as in went down. Came as quite a surprise, too, because the experts who get paid to figure this stuff out had been expecting a 5 or a 6% increase in new home sales. And oh, by the way, the used home number that we got yesterday was quite healthy, thank you very much. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale explains why and how everybody got it so wrong.
There are plenty of reasons to think new homes should be selling. Prices have come down, interest rates are at record lows, first-time buyers get tax incentives. Yesterday, we learned that existing home sales jumped a healthy 7% in the same month. So today's decline left housing economist Lawrence White at NYU's Stern School of Business at a loss.
At the end of the day, I think, you know, we're basically just scratching our heads. We don't have a great explanation. This may just be a one-month anomaly.
But another expert, Jared Franz at T. Rowe Price, has a personal experience that may explain what's going on. He and his wife recently bought a used home after looking at new ones.
One of the reasons was because we had more negotiating power. We knew that it was a foreclosure. On the other hand, when we went to look at new homes, builders were very firm, not wanting to cut prices. So I think there's a negotiating power that you have that you can really negotiate hard on an existing home.
Foreclosures are boosting the availability of affordable used homes. But new home construction has been at a standstill. Inventory is now the lowest since the early 1970s. Scarcity keeps sellers from bargaining. One more anecdotal trend. Franz says new homes are usually built where land is cheaper, outside the city.
We figured we want to kind of downsize and, you know, commute to work, have a shorter commute. So we were willing to go into an existing home rather than purchase, you know, far out in the suburbs.
Home builders blame the lack of sales on high unemployment and a slow recovery. Housing economists say 1 month doesn't make a bearish trend. They're still expecting a sustained housing rebound, although it may take springtime temperatures to get people in a buying mood. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Not far behind housing on the list of industries that are in some degree of distress, you will find cars. And along those lines, Ford said today it has agreed to the substantive parts of a deal to sell its Swedish brand, Volvo, to the Chinese carmaker Geely. Separately this week, another Chinese carmaker, Beijing Automotive, bought some technology from a different Swedish brand owned by a different American carmaker. That would be Saab, which General Motors is desperate to unload. And a couple of months ago, yet a third Chinese company agreed to buy Hummer. From New York, Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more on what this trend might mean for the worldwide car market.
Chinese carmakers have been exporting to the developing world for a while. This will help them compete in the rest of the world.
Well, they're trying to enter the global market in a big way.
Bruce Belzowski is a researcher at the University of Michigan's Transportation Research Institute. He says by buying Volvo, Geely can just pick up where Ford left off.
That would give them entree to all the world's markets that Volvo's in, which is probably almost all the major markets.
It also gives Geely a head start on the technology side. Michael Robinette does global forecasting at CSM Worldwide. It's a consulting firm. He says that's true for any Chinese carmaker that buys a Western company's technology.
Manufacturers that purchase tooling and or capability through a Volvo or a Saab don't have to reinvent the wheel every time they want to move into the market. What they're going to have to do is to continue to refine the wheel, and there's a big difference.
the auto market is very competitive right now. Companies are fighting for customers in growing markets like China and stagnating ones like North America. Belzowski, the University of Michigan researcher, says companies like Geely will have to find their own niches.
To come into a market, you have to have something that no one else has. Could be low prices, could be new technology, could be styling. Something or a completely new segment of the market.
It may be a while, though, before Western carmakers have to worry about competitors like Geely. Robinette, the consultant, says he thinks companies like Geely will concentrate on their very competitive home market first, and then they'll move into places like India before trying to fight for the U.S. and Europe. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
There are days I really, really want a smartphone, and there are days I am really glad I am not a captive to them. Yesterday was one of those. Another BlackBerry blackout last night left users of the usually reliable device with idle thumbs for the second time in less than a week. Email and web service was out for several hours last night, leaving 36 million addicted users feeling somewhat out of touch, although a service was finally restored this morning. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports the company does need to be careful with its reputation.
You can't ask for a better endorsement than one from the country's customer-in-chief. You might recall it was none other than the president-elect who told ABC's Barbara Walters he was determined to hang on to his BlackBerry when he took office.
I'm negotiating to figure out how can I get information from outside of the 10 or 12 people who surround my office in the White House.
Such is the passion of BlackBerry users that Mr. Obama succeeded in keeping his BlackBerry, and we can only assume he felt as much isolation as other users when their link to the outside world went dead. But would it be enough to make them switch allegiances? Forrester research analyst Ellen Daly says a growing number of rivals have their eye on the business market that BlackBerry's maker, Research in Motion, pioneered.
Important for RIM. They really are the face of reliability and security for mobile devices. And every outage, kind of knocks them down a little bit in terms of that trusting provider.
But Daly is quick to add, Research in Motion still has a solid lock on the market.
The outages are a bummer, but the competition can't really leverage much because they don't have an offering comparable.
She says the iPhone and Google's Droid look promising, but still have a very long way to go to prove their security and reliability. And Kevin Michaluk, who publishes the website crackberry.com, says if anything, these outages just prove the point.
When you have a hiccup like this, where he goes down for hours, that's a big hiccup for sure. And it annoys a lot of people, myself included. A day like yesterday is torture. But it's kind of one of those things where a little separation, I think, makes you, the heart grow fonder because you almost realize just how indispensable the device is.
Michaluk says when users spend hour after hour, day after day with their BlackBerries, a brief outage like this doesn't really add up to much. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
You got to get away from them, man, I'm telling you. Research in Motion shareholders didn't vote with their thumbs today, though. RIM shares were off a barely relevant 0.6%. Elsewhere on Wall Street this Wednesday, the Dow and the S&P squeaked out a win. The NASDAQ did a bit better. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Here's the thing about running a business. You got to spend money to make money. In an economy where credit, that is the ability to borrow, is still really tight, that can be a problem for small businesses, especially. They get a double whammy because after 2 years of a lousy economy, so many small business owners have bad credit scores. And that is where some creative lending comes in. KQED's Rob Schmitz has more.
Shireen Peretti thought she had a great idea for a business. She lives in an L.A. suburb popular among Israeli immigrants, many who don't speak English. So she dreamt of building a preschool with a Hebrew and English curriculum. Hoping to secure a loan, she wrote up a business plan based on research that confirmed her idea would be profitable. She presented the plan to banks.
But the banks, I don't think they're that concerned about that.
Loan officers told Peretti their banks used to accept a home as collateral, not now. Since the recession hit, banks are looking for something more, additional properties or a large household income.
So that was very challenging, trying to go to a bank and just saying, okay, of course I don't have income because I'm starting up a business, but we would like a loan.
But banks are skittish about lending money. They've withstood huge losses after a decade of doling out easy credit. Marilyn Landis is former chair of the National Small Business Association.
small businesses were walking into their lenders and flipping their high credit scores and showing them the equity in their home, and nobody was doing the tough work.
Prior to that era of easy credit, community banks required a lot more than a credit score. They looked at how long you lived in the community, who were your friends, they closely examined your business plan, they checked your math, and they didn't let a computer decide the outcome. In hindsight, those were the good old days of lending. One lender hopes these tough times will bring it all back.
Over the past 12 to 18 months, we've become the place to come to for direct business lending.
Roberto Berrigan directs the Valley Economic Development Center. Banks may not be lending to small businesses, but they're willing to lend to his nonprofit so that he can make the loans.
Some of these banks are realizing, look, we're taking a 10% hit on our small business loan portfolio. You know, we're managing losses right now. We know we're going to come under scrutiny, particularly TARP-supported banks, but we need to do something.
In essence, banks have outsourced their lending to Berrigan Center. U.S. Bank, Bank of America, and Merrill Lynch have already lent millions. They benefit by not having more potentially risky loans on their books. This formula, says small business expert Marilyn Landis, could serve as a model for lenders nationwide. After all, the way these banks used to lend has served as a model for Berrigan. Before signing off on a loan, his staff demands business plans. They look at management experience and a commitment to the community.
4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
And that's how Shireen Peretti, the woman with a dream to build a preschool, got a $35,000 loan from Berrigan Center. She now runs Today's Montessori, a bilingual preschool with a long waiting list. She says the center's staff paid her multiple visits, carefully scrutinizing her experience and her business plan.
And it gave me a huge boost of confidence, actually, because I felt like these people, like, see what I see, and they understand that there's a need for this and that it's unique and that we'll be able to recoup our cost.
24, 25, 26.
Berrigan's nonprofit recently received $15 million from the city of L.A. to provide loans to small businesses. He's on track to lend $5 million of that by the end of the year. In Los Angeles, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
There's no lack of really big economic news this year. We had bank failures and bank bailouts, climate change and healthcare change, the technical end of the worst recession in 75 years. But we got to thinking that with all of that, maybe we missed something. News that slipped by without enough notice. So we asked a couple of our regulars for the economic stories that didn't quite make the headlines. Commentator Dan Dresner says one of the biggest was a change in the way we study the economy itself.
For decades, there was a clear but unspoken pecking order in the social sciences. Economists were royalty, and every other discipline was peasantry. Economists were treated as real scholars, with their very own Nobel Prize in everything. Political scientists, on the other hand, were mocked for having the word science in the title. The old joke goes that an economist who switches to political science raises the average intelligence of both disciplines. It's not true, but the perception is powerful. Powerful enough for Senator Tom Coburn to have tried scrapping National Science Foundation funding for poli-sci earlier this year. Coburn's efforts failed, however, and for good reason. 2009 was a banner year for political scientists and a not-so-banner year for economists. The dismal science was racked by vicious infighting over its failure to anticipate the 2008 financial crisis. To be sure, the economics profession was not completely responsible for the meltdown of markets. The proponents of efficient markets theory, however, did contribute to a laissez-faire regulatory approach that allowed the asset market bubble to expand and then pop. While economists have taken a hit, the demand for political science has never been greater. In 2009, the U.S. Department of Defense started its Minerva program. It awards multi-million dollar grants to political scientists to better understand areas of strategic importance to U.S. national security policy. Risk consulting based on political science models also exploded in the past year. And in 2009, half of the Nobel Prize in Economics was awarded to Eleanor Ostrom, who is, wait for it, a political scientist. Why is political science so hot? The Great Recession has dramatically increased the role of government in the economy. The more power given to the state, the greater the interest in analyzing how and why governments do what they do. The smart political scientists are meeting this demand with trenchant research and critical commentary. As for the not-so-smart political scientists, well, maybe they can switch to economics.
Dan Dresner is a professor of international politics at Tufts University. His most recent book is called All Politics is Global. Drop us a line. Tell us what stories you think have been undercovered this year. Your thoughts, always welcome. Our website is marketplace.org. Coming up, piling on coursework to keep up coverage.
That begins to make it really difficult for students to be successful, to have a competitive grade point average in all those full-time units to stay on their parents' coverage.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials inched up a fraction of 1% today. That is 1 point closed at 10,466. The NASDAQ notched 0.75% higher, 16 points, 2269. The S&P 500 rose more than 0.25%, 2 points, ended at 1120. Software company Red Hat topped 5% after it reported better than expected earnings today. Micron Technologies hiked up 6% after it posted its first profit in 3 years. The news lifted other tech companies as well. Apple jumped up 0.8%. Microsoft ticked up 0.25% today. Card maker American Greetings fell 0.1% despite reporting good earnings. Wells Fargo slipped more than 1% on news it has repaid its bailout to the government. Ford drove up nearly 2% on the news we mentioned earlier. It sold Volvo to a Chinese company named Geely, which is not apparently that Ben Affleck movie. I don't know. 10-year T-note rose. The yield fell to 3.76%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead. Why is a derivative like a Thanksgiving turkey? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify the worlds of finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up December 24th, the night before Christmas. The Commerce Department releases November data on durable goods orders, stuff that should last more than 3 years. Wall Street closes shop early, just in time for the holiday and lunch. And industrialist, aviator, and movie maker Howard Hughes was born on tomorrow's date in 1905. Did I mention wealthy? Yeah, he was also very wealthy. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. For those planning a big feast Christmas Day, the menu is probably already set. The roast and the potatoes and the carrots and the whatnot are already in the fridge. What about drinks, though? You might want some nice wine to go with that holiday dinner. Wines that can, unfortunately, get expensive, even though they don't have to. Author Dara Moskowitz-Grumdahl has some suggestions for the casual wine consumer in her new book. It's called Drink This.
The reason that I wanted to write this book is because you look at this sort of relationship where they're, you know, it's asymmetric and they know so much and you know don't know anything. And how can you even that out? Well, the one thing that you can know that they don't know is your own taste.
Which sounds pretty simple, but every time I go into a wine shop, it gets really complicated really quickly. So the question really is, do wine sellers make it confusing for shoppers on purpose?
Yeah, they do. They took a big survey, this big company called Constellation Wine Brands, and the largest category of people who consume wine once a week or more. Like, so regular consumers, the biggest category was overwhelmed. Overwhelmed.
Yeah, never a good thing. And obviously being overwhelmed leads to poor decision making. And if you don't know what you're paying for, you're going to pay more than you need to.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that you have to realize is that there's essentially no correlation between price and value in that way. I kind of in the book go into a big, you know, what's the difference between an $8, a $15, and an $80 bottle of wine? And the short answer is the $8 bottle of wine, that's a commodity. That's, you know, like corn in Iowa. There's a tractor. There's, you know, fruit coming in bulk. There's giant tanks. The $15 wine, then you're talking about hand labor process. Okay, but then you get into the $80 wines. It's not about the cost of production. At that point, it's maybe there's some marketing in it, but then it's all just about collectability.
Does it make economic sense for me to try to make myself smart without going in and talking to a wine store person? I mean, can I go out and buy, I don't know, $100 worth of wine and reasonably educate myself that way? Does that make sense?
You know, it depends on how focused you are. I mean, I think that probably the fastest thing you can do is, you know, you go in, you figure out, okay, these are the five major styles of Sauvignon Blanc. You try them. Then you basically decide, like, you know what? I like clean and crisp, young, inexpensive Sauvignon Blanc. That was my favorite. And then you've actually learned something. But if you're just getting things haphazardly, you're just bringing chaos into your mind, which I don't recommend.
Yeah, which nobody needs.
No.
You know, you have a passage actually early on in the book where you talk about the methodology of figuring out these scents and aromas and flavors and tastes. And basically what you say is, you know, if you want to know what coffee in a wine smells like, well, stick some coffee beans in a wine glass and give it a smell, and that's how you figure it out.
Oh, yeah. It makes all the difference in the world. And you can put nectarine slices in there. And the first time you do it, you might feel a little bit like, oh, what am I doing with a glass full of peppercorns? But it makes all the difference in the world. And then, you know, you swirl it around and you kind of smell and you're like, this is what pepper smells like coming out of a wine glass. You know, I have little kids and it's been really apparent to me how much for babies one runs this kind of boot camp on shape and color. You're just like, it's a green tree. It's a red circle. Do you see the red circle? Do you see it? But you never ask them, do you smell the banana? Do you know what a strawberry smells like? Do you know what peppercorns smell like? We just don't have a vocabulary for it. And so when someone goes and says, I smell tar coming out of this glass, you think like, oh, you're pretentious and icky. Like, what are you doing? But it doesn't have to be that way. And if you do that kind of little trick, that'll get you far.
The book by Dara Moskovitz-Grumdahl is called Drink This, Wine Made Simple. Dara, thanks a lot.
Oh, thank you.
If you want to find out how to get the best wine for your holiday party, one that's, say, $15 or less, also to read an excerpt from Dara's book, you can do all that on our website, marketplace.org. I don't know if they just want to get the whole thing over with an hour earlier or if maybe Majority Leader Harry Reid's got a plane to catch, but the Senate has moved up its final vote on health care reform. This would be the final, final vote. It's going to happen bright and early tomorrow, 7 Washington time, instead of the original 8 o'clock on Christmas Eve morning. The bill that is going to be voted on tomorrow has become more about insurance reform than anything else, insurance that the majority of Americans get through their employers. With the economy still struggling and unemployment holding at double digits, a lot of new college graduates can't find jobs, let alone jobs with health insurance. So some students are getting smart about staying insured. From KQED, Sarah Varney explains.
Sarah Myers listens politely as her classmates stumble through a beginning Portuguese class at Berkeley City College in Berkeley, California. Sarah is an eager student, but she doesn't really need to learn Portuguese. Actually, she'd rather not be in school at all.
I mean, I graduated from reputable university with highest honors, like double majoring. I had all this work experience, and it was like, anybody want it? Nobody interested?
When Sarah couldn't get a job, she decided to take a few classes she'd need for graduate school and prep for the grad school entrance exam. But as a part-time student, she could no longer be insured under her parents' health plan.
And so they were the ones who were like, if you can't find a job, like, you should really think about extending your course load so that you'd still be insured under us.
Now at community college, Sarah might as well be holding a sign, "We'll study for health insurance." No one knows how many students in the U.S. are taking extra courses or enrolling in community colleges just to keep their health coverage. But 16% of young adults are unemployed, and about a third are uninsured. That's making community college an attractive option.
If you look at it from like a cost perspective, it's so much cheaper to be a full-time student.
Sarah would pay $200 to $300 a month for an individual policy. Instead, her parents are paying just a few $100s a year to enroll her full-time in community college.
Where did we come up with this notion about having to be enrolled full-time to be eligible for my parents' insurance?
Bill Oy is dean of student life at Diablo Valley College, a community college in the San Francisco suburb of Pleasant Hill. He says most students have full or part-time jobs just to afford car insurance, gas, and rent.
carrying a full course load just isn't possible.
If you just do the math of that, that begins to make it really difficult for students to be successful, to have a competitive grade point average in all those full-time units to stay on their parents' coverage.
Healthcare reform would change that. Children could remain on their parents' insurance until they turned 27, whether they were in school or not. The new policy would take effect immediately after the bill is signed. That would come as a welcome relief for Ariel Lehner. She'd planned on taking a year off between high school and college, but now she's in her first semester at Diablo Valley.
I was making a list of all that I could do while I took that gap year.
Ariel is disabled with a form of childhood cancer that left her in leg braces. She couldn't get insurance on her own, so she's going to school full time so she can stay on her parents' plan.
Being, you know, thrust into school not knowing what I want my goal from school to be yet was not the right decision for me. And I feel like I would be more sure of who I am and who I was going to be if I was able to explore that a little bit more by traveling or working.
Instead, Ariel travels every day from her home to the classroom. In San Francisco, I'm Sarah Varney for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Bank of America, working to meet the capital needs of qualified businesses and consumers. Learn more at bankofamerica.com/ahead. By Novo Nordisk, committed to changing diabetes through treatments, partnerships, and education. Defeating diabetes is our passion and our business. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, comment, I suppose, on the state of the American stock market. Shares of Citigroup fell 1.5% today. The proximate cause seems to have been Citi's finally completing its repayment of TARP money, but that's not really what I wanted to mention. This is. There are 28 billion shares of Citi stock outstanding. That is basically 4 shares of that company stock for every single person on the planet, which is kind of wild. Now, for extra credit, what are the other 4 U.S. companies that have enough shares for all 6 billion some odd people on this earth to get at least one of them? We'll tell you the answer to that one tomorrow on the broadcast. But for now, that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow edged up a point, a fraction of 1%. The NASDAQ down 16.75%. The S&P 500 bumped up 2 points. That is more than 0.25% there. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Tune in to the Marketplace Morning Report tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. It's early, too. Coming up next time on this broadcast, putting those unfinished construction projects to good use.
We don't want vacant buildings, buildings that are unable to sell, unable to rent up, to further destabilize the market in those neighborhoods.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.